Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today it's Bird News with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
Kind of some, you know, weird weather. It's been warm, you know, rainy, and then we're going to get some snow tomorrow. And what is the, does this confuse the birds at all, this weird weather?
Confuses or, me.
It confuses me, too. But I don't have to say I don't mind the warm. But I'm just wondering, you know, I guess it's good for the birds, right? It isn't freezing cold.
Right. Yes, it can be. The wild fluctuations is kind of new normal. It can be weird for some species. But, the deep cold is worse. And mm-hmm. so the more warm periods like this has been kind of the new normal over recent years. It's a lot of the way that warming kind of manifests is in average warmer winter temperatures. And it sort of benefits species that try to winter a little bit further north than maybe they used to. But, you know, then we'll get a deep freeze. It was pretty cold last week, and mm-hmm. it's all over the place. So yeah. Who knows?
So, but it doesn't affect migration, but it isn't the weather, right? It's something more in the birds. They just know it's time to go, whether it's warm or cold. Is that true?
I mean, migration in the truest sense is really over. It's movement of birds now is in response to weather and resources. So, like, you know, ducks will settle in to the north of us, and they'll leave when everything freezes up. Mm-hmm. And then they'll come further south. So they'll do these kind of shorter distance movements in response to freeze-ups and food resources being used up and that kind of thing. You know, robins will move further south if they find that we don't have enough fruit around here, mm-hmm. things like that. But migration in the phenological, in the kind of like birds migrate at a certain time of year, that's pretty much over.
Yeah, yeah. At this point. All right. 866-999-4626 is our number if you have bird comments, questions, or stories. We'll talk about other critters too. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So we had the waterfowl census this last weekend.
Yes, the venerable Cape Cod waterfowl census. Yeah. We found ducks.
Lots of ducks.
Ducks still exist. Rest assured. So this is a great citizen science project started by Blair Nicola many years ago. I'm trying to remember exactly how long it's been, around 30 years. I need to check. But it's been going on a long time. It was Blair and the Cape Cod Bird Club. And it was an effort started to try to census the waterfowl on the freshwater bodies on the Cape, right? Mostly the kettle ponds and other freshwater. And there are many hundreds of them, as you might imagine, maybe you've never thought about it. But there are a lot. And so volunteers go out. It's citizen science. So these are just volunteer birders, and they have their beat. You know, they might have part of a town, you know, some subset of the ponds in a town. Or like me, I cover all the ponds in East Ham, but there are only like a dozen. You do it over the course of the first weekend in December. You record all the ducks and some other things like gulls, you know, loons, grebes, water birds, basically. And you look at what's happening over time. And there have been some clear results over time. Certain species that have dropped off, like a beautiful duck called the canvasback, used to be common, at least on certain ponds on the Cape. Now they're gone, basically. You can still find them on Nantucket. And I think there's a bunch on like Hummock Pond on Nantucket right now, which is often the case. But pretty much everywhere else, you're just not going to see a canvasback. And there used to be hundreds in the early days of the waterfowl census.
Now, why would there be some on Nantucket but not anywhere else?
I don't know. Nantucket's special.
It is special, but I mean...
I mean, that pond, Hummock Pond, is just full of it, incredible diversity of ducks and other things. There's snow geese there right now.
Oh.
But in terms of canvasbacks, for the most part, they've shifted where they winter, like further west is apparently what they found. Other things have held steady. What would your guess be of the most common duck on the waterfowl census? It's a good guess.
Is it right?
No. Maybe it is. I don't. I think it's bufflehead.
If you go around, bufflehead.
Pretty much every pond, if you look hard enough, every little, you know, those little tiny ponds that you could throw a rock across, mm-hmm. if they're going to have a duck, it'll be a bufflehead.
Is that right?
Or a couple of mallards, yeah.
So, I would say because I seem to see mallards more than anything else. But,
right. Yeah. Well, they're bigger and you know what they are.
Yeah, true.
Bufflehead. buffleheads can be inconspicuous, and you know, they're tiny. They're like a bathtub toy.
But they're so cute.
Yeah, they're everywhere, and they're versatile. So they're on salt water too, like some of these ducks. Black ducks have declined. I know that's true in general. I have to check whether that's true in the Cape Cod data, but black ducks have definitely declined over the years, and they're closely related to mallards. The females look very similar, and they hybridize. If you look at enough flocks of mallards, you'll see these half black duck, half mallard male. The males are easier. It's usually, it looks like a black duck, but it has a green stripe on the head, sort of along the top of the head. That's the classic hybrid, a blallard, as some of us call them, black duck mallard hybrid. So I think that's part of the reason black ducks are declining, but it's a little bit of a mystery in other ways. But they, we provide important habitat for that species here on the Cape because they like to winter in salt marshes and eat things like snails.
So the ducks that would be both in freshwater and saltwater, what, why both? Is it just a matter of they're swimming in the water, or are they eating something in both places? I mean, are they eating things in
the
saltwater?
Yeah, it's all about food.
Yeah. So what are they? What are the things that they're eating then?
It depends on the species. Like black duck versus mallard, black ducks are more carnivorous, I guess you'd say, eating invertebrates, things like snails and small crabs and things like that. Whereas mallards are probably more, they're both omnivorous, but mallards tend to be more vegetarian overall, eating a lot of aquatic vegetation and that kind of thing. Acorns, like wood ducks like to eat acorns. They hang out in shallow ponds where acorns fall into the water and eat acorns. And then there are all the diving ducks. And one subset of the diving ducks eats shellfish, like freshwater mussels and saltwater mussels and snails and things. Buffleheads are among those. They like to eat snails. And then the other diving ducks are chasing down fish and underwater and eating them, you know, like a cormorant or a loon would do.
Yeah.
Things like the mergansers, like hooded mergansers are, they're in little ponds and they're chasing around, you know, banded killifish and things, eating small fish in the ponds.
What about the wood ducks? They're not so common, right? I mean, it seems like everybody gets excited when you see one.
They're considered common overall and doing well. They're still popular with hunters, and the State Wildlife Agency sort of keeps tabs on waterfowl in general and says they're doing well. But on the Cape, it's not that easy to find wood ducks on the Cape. You can find them in some of the more wooded ponds, like in Nickerson State Park and some places, and they do breed here. I know people who've had them breeding in boxes in their yard. They live on a wetland. They like swampy, you know, the kind of ponds that have old dead trees in them and that, you know, places like that, shallow, lots of water lilies. But I don't see very many wood ducks, and I wish I saw more because they're
so beautiful. Yeah.
I mean, just a stunning animal, never mind bird.
Yeah.
Just like a work of art.
So you mentioned hunters. What, they don't eat them, do they? Do you eat a wood duck?
Yeah. Yeah, I would think so. I would think a wood duck would be half decent. I've had ringneck duck. That might be the only wild shot duck that I've had. That was in Florida. My boss cooked it. I had to eat it. Settle down. Stop writing letters. It's part of being a locavore. Yeah. But it was sort of gamey and chewy. I've not tried wood duck, but I wouldn't think they'd be too bad. They're as a more of a vegetarian type duck.
Yeah. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Right, so we had the...
Let's put that out. Have you eaten a wood duck? Have you eaten any kind of duck? Are they good? What do they taste like? You know the recipe for eider. There's people out there right now. It's sea ducks, right, season.
Yeah.
And this is it's a thing. It's more of a thing than I realized. There are outfitters who... just like there are striped bass charters, there are hunting, like sea duck hunting charters that go out in places like Chatham, and you pay the money and they take you out and you shoot things like eiders and scoters. But the recipe for eider is that you boil it for an hour in some water with a brick.
Oh my.
And then you throw away the eider and eat the brick.
Oh, dear.
It's a classic. It's a classic joke. Come on. It's good stuff.
All right. So the waterfowl census happened last weekend, and now we're getting ready for the Christmas bird counts.
Yes. Yeah, December is a big, citizen science month in birding. And the biggest of all, the oldest of all, I think, is the Christmas bird count. And so this has been around since 1900. And so we're coming into the, you know, 120th year of this very well-known, very important citizen science project. And it started as an alternative to competitive hunts that used to happen on Christmas Day, where there would be two sides. They called it the side hunt, meaning there were two sides, and you'd compete to see how many birds you could shoot on Christmas morning. And so Frank Chapman, famous ornithologist, was like, yeah, how about we just see how many we can count? And so thus started the Christmas bird count. In the first year, I think there were 27 counts from like Toronto to Boston to California. And they only got 89 species. I was looking at the results a while back, and it was the results are very strange. They only had three species of duck, so they didn't seem to be focusing on water at all. They had 27 people across the country counted 89 species.
Well, you would think it would be higher than that.
And it was weird. There were a few counts around Boston, like somebody did the Arnold Arboretum, and there was one in Winchester. I know you'd think they would get more than that. But it's evolved, and it's been basically the same for 100 years or more. And that's what you want. You want consistency in a long-term citizen science project like this. You want to do it the same way over time. And so basically, observers go out on a set day, and the count period goes from the middle of December to January 5th. And so it's just about to start. The first counts will be this weekend. The Buzzards Bay count is Saturday, and the Cape Cod count, which is centered on Chatham, is Sunday. And so thus starts the Christmas bird count season, which is very exciting. And so observers will go out in a 15-mile circle centered on a certain point, and you cover the same circle every year, and you just go out for the whole day. You could go for 24 hours if you wanted
to. Well, you got to get up early to do the owls, right?
Right. You get up early. Some people get up really, like, go out at 1 a.m. or midnight to start owling. I'll usually start at like 4:30, something like that, owling, sometimes earlier. But that's a fun part of it, just seeing, you know, are there any saw-whets around? Can you pick up anything else? You can get a barred owl, something interesting. And then you want to be out at dawn anyway because you get some good things right at dawn. And you come back at the end of the day. And then the social aspect of it, where you come together often at somebody's house, there's food, you know, there's a crock pot full of chili, and people are talking about what they saw. It's a bunch of bird people together, you know, it's like fishermen or any other hobby, all talking shop and keeping their rare birds in their back pocket for like the end, you know, like, oh.
Who can top that?
Rufus hummingbird. Yeah. and so, yeah, it's a lot of fun. And it's intense. And a lot of people who've never done it before are like, yeah, I want to try it. And probably like a half day or something is good for someone who's never done it before. If you're not someone who likes to get up early on a freezing day and bird for 14 hours, then, you know, I get some people who help on the churro count where, you know, they disappear at lunch and that's fine. You know, you get a morning out of them, and they get some exposure to it, and then maybe the next year they stay the whole day, and they really catch the fever. But it is intense, and it's a little bit competitive. You want to beat your species total from last year in your area. Mm-hmm. So people tend to have a subsection of the circle that they're responsible for, and you want to do better than you did last year, and you want to hit all the good spots. And over time, you accumulate these spots, you know, like, oh, we've got to check that place where the McGillivray's warbler was that one time. And so you find yourself checking some little patch of woods year after year because there was one rare bird that one time. And so it gets harder and harder to finish your area in one day because you keep checking all these spots where you had a rare bird once.
Yeah, and in a way, you're calling the birds, right? Because you use the owl sound. Tell us what's going on there, why the birds would come out for this.
Yeah, so not everybody does this, but the best way to get a lot of birds quickly and get them counted is to use a screech owl tape. And this is an old fashioned method that we now do with new technology. Like now it's an MP3 and a Bluetooth speaker. When I first started doing Christmas counts, there was a guy who's since passed away who showed me this method, and you had a tape player with D batteries in it, and you hung the hand like a little mini boombox, and a loop tape that you made from a CD of screech owl call, and then you hang that on a tree somewhere, and you know, usually in some kind of wet thicket with a tangly thicket with some water in it, and then the birds just come out of, literally come out of the woodwork. Like, you would have sworn there was nothing. See? There it is. Oh, there's bird. Stop, Dan. There's birds coming into the studio right now. they can't stay away. And so what's happening is they're mobbing a predator.
Yeah, they're like, let's get him before he gets us.
It seems strange to people. Like, why does that work? What is that sound? You know, people are walking down the street like, what is that? It sounds like there's a giant owl. And so the chickadees are usually the first ones in, the chickadees and the titmice, and they start raising a ruckus. And that's what you want, because then that gets the other birds' attention. And before you know it, you have this big cluster of birds all kind of, you know, popping up out of the thicket, and maybe something like a yellow-breasted chat pops up, and you see it really quickly. And you wouldn't have seen that without playing the tape. You know, you can do pishing and things like that, but it's efficient, and it's a spot that you only check once a year. It's not like you're going there every day and harassing these birds by playing an owl tape. It's literally that once a year for a 5 minutes, and then you move on. You get the birds counted, and you move on. And, you know, you would have, if you didn't use the tape, you would have said there were five chickadees and a downy woodpecker, and that was it. You play the tape.
A lot more with the tape.
And there's 15 chickadees, eight, you know, titmice, six nuthatches,
and
five other species,
chat.
Chat, and a catbird pops up. Yeah, catbirds winter on the Cape. And it's hard to know that unless you go around playing screech owl tapes. I had four catbirds in a thicket in East Ham the other day while I was doing the waterfowl census, and most people would say catbirds have been gone for weeks.
Yeah.
But a few settle in to some thickety, usually a swampy thicket where there's some fruit, and try to overwinter. And that's the kind of fun things that you find with doing these Christmas counts.
Right. Let's talk to Cynthia, who's giving us a call from Barnstable. Good morning, Cynthia.
Good morning, Mindy. How are you?
Good.
Good. My question for Mark is, I know we're all concerned about all the invasive bittersweet and multiflora rose and, et cetera, et cetera. And I'd like to try and get rid of as much of it as possible. But I'm curious as to how much of a food source it is for the birds that we have here now.
Yeah, that's a good question.
Wow, this is like a planted question. You read my mind, because this was something I wanted to talk about anyway. That's a very, very good question. And so the answer is it depends on the season. And so I'm probably going to talk for a long time here, so buckle your seatbelt. So a study just came out, and our friend Trevor Lloyd Evans at Manomet, formerly Manomet Bird Observatory, was one of the authors, and they used the banding data from Manomet, and they looked at what fruit the birds were eating during the fall migration, so, you know, September, October, and they found that the birds were eating native fruits almost exclusively, despite the fact that the landscape itself was mostly invasive fruits, things like bittersweet, privet, honeysuckle, those kinds of things. They're so common on the landscape. And so the birds were seeking out the native fruits, and so they were by far the most important. And so that's what people should probably focus on, but when it comes to making landscaping decisions. But in the winter, that changes. And I was thinking about this, like the winter birds sort of screw over the migrant birds because the winter birds are eating the invasive fruits. Once it gets to be this time of year, the native fruits, the softer ones like viburnums and grapes and pokeweed and things like that, they're all gone. And so they're left with the hollies, the native hollies, winterberry, American holly, inkberry, things like that. But overwhelmingly, the landscape is covered in bittersweet and multiflora rose, and birds love them. Mm. Multiflora rose in particular. When I'm reading a landscape in the winter to try to find interesting birds, I'm going where there's multiflora rose, which is a nasty invasive plant that, as an ecologist, you don't want that on the landscape. But as a winter birder, that's where I'm going to look for a chat or overwintering catbird or something like that.
But if Cynthia wants to get rid of it in her yard, she could replace it with...
So then the question is, what do you replace it with? Winterberry is readily available at nurseries. It's beautiful this time of year. It's the red fruits persist into the winter until the robins and sometimes bluebirds come and clean it out. I often get robins and bluebirds together on mine. I only have one. I would like to add more, but I really enjoy that one day when the robins and the bluebirds come and eat all the winterberry fruits. Mm. But like I said, there's three species of native hollies around here. Two of them are evergreen, the inkberry and American holly, and then the winterberry is a deciduous holly. And it's a common plant in swamps around here, but it's also a common, easy landscaping plant that you can add. And even, you know, a lot of people have the ornamental crab apples that have very small fruits. And the king of native plants these days is this guy, Doug Tallamy, who's a professor down in Delaware. And even he says, though they're not strictly native, these ornamental crab apples, they support a lot of native pollinators in terms of the larval form of insects. But then their fruits persist through the winter and are really a favorite of things like robins and waxwings. So you can add an ornamental crab in your front yard. I'd have to look into the varieties. There's a Zumi is like an old one that works with birds really like, Zumi crab apple. I think Prairie Fire works well.
All right.
But anyway.
You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News this morning with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And Jan is calling from Oak Bluffs. Good morning, Jan.
Good morning. I'm not a birder. I love this show, and I love when people tell me about birds, but to me, they're all just kind of birds. And the other day, we were heading to Lucy Vincent Beach, which is in Chilmark, and at the entrance to Lucy Vincent Beach, a big bird went over, which my partner, who is a birder, said, oh, a GBH, a great blue heron. And he said, that bird better get out of here because it's not going to make it through the winter. Is that bird like a lone loser, or are great blue herons hanging around longer, or...
No, they're pretty common. They're easy to find in the winter at the coast. Nice.
Oh, Dan's on it this morning. All right.
Yeah.
That's what they sound like, yeah.
It was the old name for
them.
It didn't
make a noise when I heard it. I just saw it flying.
I think an old hunter's name for them was Big Grumpy. And they sound grumpy. They're like a grumpy pterodactyl.
They're so beautiful. I think they're beautiful.
Oh, they're impressive. Yeah. They're gigantic. They're gorgeous. So it depends. It depends on the winter. It's a gamble. But increasingly, they can survive the winter, especially where there's salt water, where there's moving water. They can find enough fish to keep themselves warm through the winter. I have on occasion found multiple dead individuals that had tried to overwinter in a marsh system while walking around inside the marsh. So like, it's a risk, but it's not hard to find great blue herons at the coast in winter.
Yeah. And Jan, I'm so glad that you listen, even though you don't. That was me about a decade ago. I didn't know anything about birds until we started doing the bird show. So you'll be amazed how much you can learn.
Well, it happens so very slowly, and I go backwards. I learned a few birds, and then it's like, oh, well, it's a bird. I forget what it is.
Keep trying.
Yeah.
I also wonder, do bumbleheads look like something else? Because I see a ton of black and white little tiny ducks everywhere I go.
Those are buffleheads. Well, at a distance, say if it's a freshwater pond, they're often mixed with hooded mergansers, like almost always. And say like a hooded merg male has its crest kind of down a little bit, or well, no, I guess even when it's up, they both have what looks like a big round head that's like a big white pie piece at sort of the back corner. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there are other ones, but overwhelmingly buffleheads are the most common, and I'm sure that's what you're seeing as you're driving around.
Yeah, Jen, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
866-999-4626 is our number for your bird comments, questions, or stories. We like stories. 866-999-4626, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. You mentioned a little bit ago when we talked about the Christmas bird counts, how the chickadees are usually the first ones out there. And it's so true. The chickadees, they're like the bravest little birds and the most curious.
Yeah.
Like if you just watch a chickadee, you're gonna find whatever action is around, right? Because the chickadees, they're always there for the action.
They are there for the action. Yeah, they're the first. They're morbidly curious. You know, they're the first ones on the scene when they think there's an owl. They're just amazing in so many ways. They're so little, but they have no problem surviving the winter here. Even though they have to gain some ridiculous percentage of their weight every day, they have to regain something like 25% of their body weight. I'm trying to remember the exact figure, in order to survive a cold night. And they're doing this day after day.
That's why they're the first ones at the bird feeder.
That's right. And they know.
They know.
Like, if it's been empty for 2 weeks, I'll go out and fill it, and they're like, we're here.
Yep, about time.
Like, how did, what, you know, so they're incredible. And there was some thought that migrants will sort of key in on them, like attaching yourself to a local. What a great call. That's considered the song. The song, I guess, of a chickadee. Yeah. Then that's the call. Chickadee-dee-dee. My son can do that now. Beckett.
Oh,
Beckett sometimes
right?
does chickadee. Chickadee-dee.
That's funny.
He's not quite two.
Yeah. Maybe chickadee will be his favorite bird, his best bird, as we say.
Yeah. Who knows? Yeah. It's not clear to me yet. He will be a birder. There's no, that's not negotiable. But yeah, chickadees are very respectable to bird to have as your favorite bird.
Yeah.
Because they're so impressive.
The chickadee will come to the feeder, take the seed, and go away.
Yeah.
And then come back again. It doesn't just sit there and eat. It takes it and goes somewhere and then comes back.
Right. If you watch bird feeders, like so many of us do, you'll see that there are two kinds of, there are two main kinds of birds in terms of how they interact with your feeder. There's the grab and goes. There's the drive-through birds, and those are the chickadees and the titmice and the nuthatches. And so they come in, they grab a seed, and then they go off somewhere and do something with it. Either they open it, you see them pecking away at it to open it, or they stash it somewhere. Like sometimes you'll see one just like stuck to the side of a tree, or you'll find them in the side of your picnic table and things like that. And so they do a good bit of stashing. And then there are the sit and pig out, and that's a goldfinch, a house. Yeah, the finches do that, and they just sit there and they eat and eat and eat. And that's I've known people that call goldfinches gold pigs. They get mad at them, like what? They're eating the bird seed. Isn't that
eat?
What you want them to do?
Exactly.
You put the bird seed out.
Okay. All right, Marilyn sent us an email. She says a good crab apple for birds. We've had great luck with Sargent's crab. The tiny crab apples stay on all winter. Robins love them. We had 3 feeding on them this past Sunday, and the flowers are covered with bees in the spring.
Yes.
Thanks, Marilyn. That's a good tip.
Very good.
Sargent's
That's the
crab.
This is just the kind of intel we want from the listeners.
That's
Thank
right.
you very much. Sargent's crab.
You know, I've been thinking about adding a crab apple tree to my yard, but I always think about all those crab apples on the ground. Like, you know, I have the same problem with my apples if I don't pick them all up, you know. But I don't know. Maybe it's not that bad.
It's fertilizer.
Yeah.
Or, you know, food for things.
Yeah.
Unless people feel that way about black cherry, and I kind of get that. Black cherry is one of my favorite trees. It's a common local native tree, wild black cherry, Prunus serotina. It's incredibly, incredibly important wildlife tree because so many different kinds of butterflies and moths use it as larval food plants. You know, their caterpillars eat it. In addition to all the bees that feed on are fed by the flowers, and then the fruits like cedar waxwings are, you know, all these other birds and catbirds are just chowing down on. But I wouldn't plant one over your driveway or over a walkway.
Yeah.
Because they're these kind of get these kind of stainy, you know, squishy fruits in summer when everyone's around. And,
are they long-lived trees? And because usually cherry trees last about a decade, but the regular cherry trees, you know, that you put up. What about the black cherry trees?
You see really big ones sometimes. They can live decades. I don't know the age span. You know, I don't know every nature fact, Mindy. I've certainly seen big ones, and I love them. My neighbor behind me. Is not a, you know, he's a airline pilot. He doesn't know biology or plants and things like that. And he's like, what is this tree? It looks like a weed that grew into a tree. And it was, to my eye, a beautiful black cherry at the corner of his yard. And
he's
it's
a weed. Yeah.
I see it in terms of its wildlife potential and all the birds and bees and butterflies it's going to feed. And it like arches, I thought, gracefully. They're kind of craggy looking. You know, they're gnarly, like coastal trees should be. You know, they're like surviving the storms and everything. But it's sort of arching gracefully out over just a corner of his yard where it's not really bothering anybody, but he's like wanted to get rid of it. It looks like a weed that grew into a tree. I'm like, no.
Yeah, there you go. Beauty in the eye of the beholder.
And there's some like a general gardening Facebook group I ended up on. And for some reason, everyone hates on black cherry trees.
Really?
They just get rid of them now. You know, like what? Why? I don't know.
Because they have them over their driveway.
I
maybe.
Just see the world differently than the average people, the normies, I guess.
All right, so let's talk about painted buntings. We're seeing a few of those pop up.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on. Every year is different, and every year we get, you know, one or two painted buntings turns up. and they shouldn't. It's very strange. This is a southern bird. They winter in the southeast. They winter in places like southwestern Florida. Like people go to like the feeders at Corkscrew Swamp, you know, mm-hmm. where many, many people have been. That's a, like a classic place to see your painted bunting in the winter. Not a feeder in Provincetown, as well. This should be too cold and too far north. They don't breed this far north, anywhere near this far north either. So this is a bird that flew north for the winter for no, you know. But the Cape ends up with them. If anywhere in Massachusetts gets a painted bunting, it's Cape Cod. And there have been at least three in the last month. Some good friends of ours at Wellfleet Bay, Steve and Frank up in Provincetown, had one. You're welcome. I'm in charge of where all the rare birds go. I head a committee that determines who gets rare birds.
And so you said Steve and Frank are getting that one.
Yeah, you're welcome. No, they deserve it. They do a lot. They're like all-star volunteers for us. And then a couple have turned. Typically, that's how they turn up. They turn up at somebody's feeder, and someone calls somebody, and then you know about it, or it's an e-bird. But a couple have turned up just in the course of people birding, like Bank Street Bogs, which is now called Coldbrook Preserve in Harwich. Somebody photographed one the other day. There was one at Brewster Community Gardens. And so it just seems like it's a good painted bunting year for some reason. Is a lot.
Are they as colorful in the winter as they are in the summer?
All right. So the reason they're a fun bird to talk about is mainly the male plumage. Mm-hmm. It's ridiculous what they're too good looking. They're like gaudy, right? They're just the shimmery, electric green, red, and blue, like a patchwork quilt of just iridescent colors. They're not common anywhere. And that's the other thing is there's nowhere that I can think of where you can see a lot of painted buntings. And so they're always nice to see. But typically the ones that we get, and all three of the ones I'm aware of on the Cape so far have been the female slash immature plumage. There's kind of, but interesting in their own right, they're all green, all kind of a greenish yellow. And there's really nothing else like that. So it's got that bunting shape, kind of stout with a stout conical, you know, finchy type bill. Mm-hmm. Doesn't look like a warbler. Like there are warblers that are yellowish green, but.
So if we were to see a male, it would be with all the colors that we see?
Yes.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, they keep their colors in the winter.
That's cool. Yeah. All right, let's talk to John. It's John from the Hyannis Whale Watch. Hi, John.
Hi, guys.
Hi, John.
Didn't want the year to go by without giving a yell. I was on the boat Tuesdays all year long, so I didn't have a chance to do my check-in, and I missed that.
So, give us a report. Yeah.
Well, we ended up with a pretty good season out there. The big thing missing again this year was sand lance, so we're interested to see what's going on with that important fish stock. But again, it kind of switched up the bird life out there. The whales movements but we had a good season with not a whole lot of notables out on the water, our usual suspects, and that's why I figured I'd give a call this morning. As I was down in the office by the harbor the other morning, I saw something that looked out of place, so I grabbed my bins, and it was a razorbill, which is
nice.
they're regular but not common by any means down our way. And as I sat there and looked at it, flying across the harbor and then up onto one of the pilings was a kingfisher.
Oh.
So it was to me just kind of a really neat contrast between the switching of the seasons and all that. So I figured I'd
Yeah, absolutely. A razorbill, that's let you know winter's coming, if not here. And there's this period where you still have the summer seabirds, like in into November. Often to the end of November, there's still some shearwaters out there, which are your summer seabirds that you see from the whale watch boats in, August. But then you're also seeing the razorbills, who are the winter birds coming in from the north. But by now it should pretty much just be, there might be a couple of straggler, shearwaters, but by now it's just razorbills, and you hope to see dovekies and, all the winter seabirds, sea ducks, kittiwakes, and things like that.
Yeah. So, John, when do the whale watches start up again? In the spring?
So we'll begin in the spring. Our calendar actually is going live this week for the upcoming season, but we'll begin the end of April, which is a great time for birders because you can catch some of the winter birds. We only go out on really nice days at that time of year because none of us has a stomach for cold and rough. And we've also got to watch for right whales because we're on a speed restriction until the middle of May for their presence in Cape Cod Bay.
Right.
So we're doing 10 knots across the bay. So if you want to do a lot of bay birding, that's a nice time to come out. But
wasn't there an acoustic study that just got published that from Cornell and others that said that they're pretty much in mass waters year round, the right whales?
Numbers are, especially with the recent switches in the Gulf of Maine, food stocks for them bottom line is, they're doing a lot more moving around. That's what's getting them into trouble with fishing gear way up north in the Gulf of St. Lawrence. Mm-hmm. And so with that increased movement, there's a greater chance we're going to run into one while we're out on our trips. And that's why the acoustic speaker system is so important. And the whale alert app is so important for mariners to have. So, when we're hearing them.
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of years they turn up in December now. And it's hard to believe that it's that time of year again.
It's
whale time.
John, thanks for the report. Appreciate that. Have a nice winter.
Happy holidays.
You
we'll
too.
Look forward to speaking to you in the new year.
Thanks,
Sounds
John.
Good. Thanks, John. You're listening to The Point. It is Bird News this morning with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, so you wanted to talk about short-eared owls this morning. What do we see? Are we seeing a lot of them?
It seems like it. During their what's their migration, which is kind of second half of the fall, more than usual were turning up on the Cape and Islands here from what I can remember. Places that you wouldn't normally expect them, like Crosby Beach and Brewster had one. I think Seagull Beach and Dennis. Certainly Crane. There were up to three at Crane, and that makes sense. They've done a lot of work at Crane Wildlife Management Area in Falmouth. It's a state wildlife management area. And they've removed a lot of trees, which was, some people were like, why are they removing trees? But they're really improving that habitat for a lot of species that are not doing very well because they like big open grasslands and shrublands. And that includes short-eared owls. And short-eared owls are not doing well across the continent. They've declined quite a bit. We don't see them as much in the winter. And they used to breed in Massachusetts. They still do in one island, but they have just about blinked out as a breeding bird in Massachusetts, though they used to breed at places like Monomoy back in the as recently as the 70s and 80s, and maybe even a little bit later than that. But they're pretty much gone as breeding birds. So we hope to see them in winter, and it's usually in big, open, marshy or grassy places. And so up to three were at Crane for a while, and there's probably still one around now. It's just a matter of somebody with a scope going there at dusk and really kind of peering into that scope and checking all the edges of the fields to find a short-eared owl. They're not an owl that you're going to go walk up to a tree and it's sitting in it like a great-horned owl or a screech owl.
So they're mostly on the ground?
They're an open, yes. So during the day, they're roosting in some dense vegetation on the ground somewhere, most likely, and then they become active at dusk. And so they're like the night shift version of the northern harrier. And so harriers are hunting these same areas, eating meadow voles and shrews and things. And then as it gets towards dusk, they briefly overlap and maybe squabble a little bit. And then the harriers go to bed and the short-eared owls take it from there. And they're the night shift hunting kind of open grassy areas. But they're not a bird of They're not an owl that hangs out in trees.
And they don't sound like hoo hoo.
Most owls don't, right?
Yeah. What?
Oh, he's got it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a funny sound.
Yeah,
they're
weird little barking sound.
Oh, my.
Yeah, I've never heard that one.
All right, so that's the is that the northern one, Dan? Okay, northern. And this is what? The South American one? That does sound like a hoo 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 hoo.
What is that?
South American short-eared owl.
South American short-eared owl.
This is, birds can have different accents, too.
Yeah, short-eared owls occur over big parts of the globe. And, I wasn't familiar with that call.
Yeah, see?
I know there's a Caribbean race that I saw once. I did a Christmas count in the Keys. Saw one sparring with a peregrine on the dry tortugas off of Key West.
Hawaii's only native owl is a short-eared owl subspecies.
Yes, right, because they migrate. So they breed in tundra, so they breed pretty far north, and they breed in temperate grasslands as well. But they breed up into Arctic tundra, and those Alaskan birds will migrate, and they'll end up out over the Pacific. They'll end up on boats and things way, well away from land. And so that they colonized the Hawaiian Islands. If you look at Hawaii on a map, if you get into Google Earth and you kind of spin it so you're just looking at Hawaii, there's nothing but ocean in any direction for thousands of miles. It's in the middle of nowhere. And so that was an impressive feat for any owl to colonize Hawaii. And yes, that they're the only ones there.
Yep. All right, so we got a message from Lee who says, I just saw a pair of flickers coming out of a birdhouse by my bird feeders where I have suet, sunflower hearts, thistle, black seeds, and a heated bird bath. Then they flew down to the ground, then up to the suet, then away. Are they nesting here or just checking out the birdhouse?
Yeah, nothing's really nesting right now. The birds that nest in cavities or pretty much check them out year-round, and they'll roost in them at night, even in the winter, even when they're not breeding. And so it doesn't mean anything regarding nesting unless that's a local bird and is like already claiming it for next year. But most likely they're just, using it to roost in at night, or they're just checking it out or whatever.
Let's see what's in there.
Yeah. Mostly they're just checking out your feeders. And I also have one that's been hammering away. I look out in the morning and there's just like suet bits all over the ground. I have to keep my dog away from it. And it's because the flickers are messy about it. They just hammer away at the suet and disintegrate it. They're fun to have at your suet. They're such a big, they're a big bird. Yeah. I think people are surprised by how big. People are often confused by flickers. They don't know what it is because it doesn't look like other woodpeckers.
Yeah.
It's just, they're kind of funny. They don't act like woodpeckers. They're on the ground a lot.
Yeah. Jackson was looking out the slider and I said, what do you see? And he's naming the birds. He says, I see a woodpecker. I said, a woodpecker? Looking was a flicker on the ground. How does he know that? How does he know? And I think it's the wildlife shows he watches.
When you start that young, you internalize it and you don't know. It's only later on that I had to figure out how to explain to other people why things are what they are. Yeah.
Wild Kratts. So those Kratt brothers.
The Kratt brothers.
Kratt brothers.
Yeah, we watch that.
Yeah, that's
Beckett,
a great
Beckett
show.
Loves those guys.
All right, so Joanne says, do loons stay on Cape all year? I enjoy listening to your program. I had quite a relationship with hummingbirds this year. Okay. So she wants to know, do loons stay on the Cape?
Yeah, I zoned out for a second, and I heard loons and hummingbirds and nothing else. So
she said, do loons stay on the Cape all year?
Yes. Well, no. Yes.
They do.
So they don't breed here, but there's no month of the year where you cannot find a common loon on Cape Cod. Yeah. It's easier in the winter. It's easier from like October through April, May. but they don't breed here. They breed sparingly in like central Mass. They've been reintroduced to certain big reservoirs. But as most people know, they breed in, the lakes of Maine and New Hampshire and Wisconsin and Canada. But we'll have little pods of – pods, probably not the right word – little flocks of non-breeding loons that will stay here in the summer. So occasionally you'll look out off the backside of the Cape in July or August, and there's 11 common loons in a tight little raft. Like, what are they doing? They're just like yearling birds that didn't go back to the ponds to breed. And then this time of year, we have quite a few. A lot keep moving further south, but a lot do stay here for the winter, along with red-throated loons. Red-throated loons are sometimes more common than the common loons.
Yeah.
And in migration, if you get a good migration day, you'll probably see more red-throated loons moving past than common loons. And they nest further north. They're more Arctic, subarctic nesters.
All right. Cape Cod Bird Club, Young Birder Scholarship? What's that?
Yeah. So... every year for several years now, the Cape Cod Bird Club has sponsored a scholarship for a Cape Cod teen to go to this National Audubon Camp in Maine on Hog Island. It's a beautiful island in coastal Maine, you can imagine. And they go there for a week to study coastal ornithology. They get to see puffins and guillemots and bird banding and do sketching. And so it's like a hands-on kind of ornithology program for teens, teen birders or teens who want to become biologists. And then this year, when I talked to them up at Hog Island, they were pushing this Costa Rica week for teens that they also offer, and they gave us a discount. So anyway, now we're offering two scholarships, one for Hog Island and one for Costa Rica. And the Hog Island one is just after the school year. It's like late, the end of June into July. And then the Costa Rica one is, I think, the end of July into August. And it's an incredible opportunity. I mean, it's a week in Costa Rica studying, you know, birding and ornithology for the cost of a round trip flight to Miami. They cover the cost of everything else from Miami to Costa Rica, and then the week and everything is included. And so we're scouring the schools, we're bringing flyers to the local schools, and I need to email them. We also email the science teachers and the administrators at local schools. You know, can you get the word out? Where we put it out on the Facebook birding group and things like that. So, you know, there aren't lots and lots of birder kids out there.
Yeah.
There are more than there used to be, and they're finding each other on social media, which is great. It's a great aspect of social media when it comes to birding, which is not the most socially popular thing probably, or was not historically. And so we're just asking anybody, if you know, so a teen, so the ages are 14 to 17 for the Hog Island, and actually a little bit older for the Costa Rica week. It's 15 to 19. So there might even be somebody at Four C's at the community college.
Yeah, that would be great. Right, so Christy sent us a picture, and she's wanting to know if you can tell us what kind of a hawk this is.
Yeah, it's a red-shouldered hawk. It's a beautiful, beautiful adult red-shouldered hawk. Where is that?
She says it sits in trees near the house.
Near the house.
Doesn't say where the house is, but somewhere on Cape Cod.
Okay. They're not that common on the Cape. They're a little more common this part of the Cape, like Falmouth, Bourne, Mashpee, places like that. But the outer Cape, I never see red-shouldered hawks.
Yeah.
They're way more common overall in Massachusetts than they were when I was a kid, whether they're responding to increased forestation. They like swampy forests, like red maple swamps. And so they're just way more common. I don't remember any when I was a kid, and now they're in Plymouth, and you can find them year-round in Bristol County, you know, Plymouth County, and other, really lots of the state. But not, the Outer Cape is not a place where I see them. So anyway, I'd be curious to see where.
Well, we'll send Christy a note, and we'll ask her where that is. Just about 20 seconds left, we should say. You know that winter has arrived when we start seeing the little dark-eyed juncos.
Yes.
Yes, and they're here.
Yes, they are here. They've been around for a while, but they didn't settle in under my feeders until, I don't know, with the last couple of weeks or less. But yeah, they. I think we had our first one at the banding station at Wellfleet, and actually probably right around when we did the show, live show there from the sanctuary. And
that's right. All right.
Last month.
Mark Verity, science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. Thank you, Mark. See you next month.
We'll see you.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.